Okay, I'm recording. I do not have homeworks to hand back to you because I'm still struggling with grading them, and I will get them next time. I'm sorry for the delay. And I'll be assigning a new homework in the next 24 hours, I hope. That'll be the last one. The last one is turned in the last week, which is next week. But there is no 11th week for me to turn it back to you, so I just want to notify you that what I'm going to do is have on the homework a place where you write a mailing address. And what I'll do, usually a campus box number. If you don't have a campus box number, anything else, I'm willing, you know, we can mail in the U.S. mails. And I'll send it with, and it'll be marked how many points it got, but then I'll put on it also your point total for the course and your grade. And that'll come back sometime during exam week, hopefully, if you... But I have had a lot of people put an address down, and it's where they're living right now, and at the end of the quarter, they're moving. And so by the time I get to mail it, it bounces back, and they say no such person. So anyway, so where we had gotten to in our rush-through material at the end of the course is the neutral mutation calculation. And it's explained in the book, a refrain you will hear frequently. And what you had was a formula like this, 1 minus u squared times 1 over n plus 1 minus 1 minus u squared times 1 minus 1 over 2n, sorry, 1 over 2n. And that's the probability that two copies are the same allele, because we're treating it like identity by descent, but we're allowing mutation to break identity by descent. And since each mutant is to a completely new allele, if either one copy has mutated, they cannot end up being the same allele in this scheme. Now, if you expand those out, you get 1 over 2n minus 2u over 2n plus u squared over 2n. And down here, you get 2u, let's see if I get this right, plus u squared, 2u minus u squared times... Two u minus u squared is correct, and then it will be minus u squared times 1 over 2n, I think. But anyway, the whole point of that is, and something looks a bit wrong there, I think there is another plus 1 over 2n down here. But anyway, you expand it all out, you get stuff like that, and then if somebody comes along and says, look, we're dealing with small mutation rates, and we're dealing with largish population sizes, so let's assume that terms like u and 1 over 2n are okay, but if you take a product of any two of those, or a square of any of them, it's going to be too small to make much difference. That's going to get rid of all of these terms, and then after you... Then it becomes very simple, and you end up with 1 over 1 plus 4n times the mutation rate. And that's an approximation. The other one's exact. And I make heavy weather in the book about how approximate it is, and here's some comparisons and so on. But let's just use it for the moment. If you had a population size of, let's say you had an organism with a population of size 1 million, which is not as large a number as you think, because sure, the number of cheetahs in Africa now is very small, but the number, suppose you were considering the number of white-footed deer mice in North America, well, it's very large. Suppose you were considering effective population sizes of you know, minnows or something like this, or mosquitoes, these numbers can get much larger than this. It's not an unreasonable number. When you have a mutation rate of 10 to the minus 7 per locus, because remember, you have many sites at the locus that can mutate, and we're sort of adding up across sites, what would you get? Well, you'll get, this is 10 to the 6, this is 10 to the minus 7, 4NU will be 0.4. And that means the product here is 0.1 and then times 4. So the probability of homozygosity is 1 over 1.4 or, you know, 0.7128. And that would say that the 71% of pairs that you picked out of the population will be the same allele, but 28% of them will not. Now, in fact, here is you know, here's this conceptual diagram showing you what's really happening. Alleles are rising and being lost by genetic drift, and occasionally one will arise and spread, but whenever there's a mutation among its descendants, that too is a new allele and gets counted. So even though this allele's descendants are heading to fixation, the population will not be fixed for the same allele because descendants of those will be among the things that mutate. And the heterozygosity that we see and the homozygosity that we see are just a slice across this, looking at the amount of variability when no one allele is at an equilibrium frequency. It's just a continued turnover. The homozygosity is 1 over 1 plus 4NU. The heterozygosity will be 4NU over 4NU plus 1. So you could do it either way. When you have the 71% figure, you're actually predicting that the number of cases in which two alleles chosen from the population are different is 28%. The empirical figure in Drosophila is actually 15%. In humans, it's about 7. So how would you fit the model to those? Well, the answer is you just drop 4NU down a bit. If 4NU is 0.1 instead of 0.4, so say you have a little less smaller population size or a little smaller mutation rate, then 1 over 1 plus 4NU will be 1 over 1.1 or 0.9, what would it be, 0.909. So basically then you'd expect, you'd have 90% homozygosity, and 10% of the time two alleles you chose would be different alleles, and that's closer to, say, the human figure. So the neutral mutation model can be roughly fit to variation in natural populations. Now, what I want to do with this, there's more considerations here, and there's a big section in the notes on geographic variation when you have migration versus genetic drift, and then migration versus genetic drift in the presence of mutation as well. I don't have time for that. We're out of time to cover that. So what I'm going to do is move along to natural selection, because here you get a sense in this simple model of how much mutation, to what extent is mutation able to counter genetic drift? The answer is, if 4NU is large, then mutants will be coming into the population faster than they can be eliminated by genetic drift. And there will be a balance, but the balance will be for having many alleles around. If 4NU is small, it means that the population will tend to be mostly homozygous, which means the population will drift to fixation for an allele for a while, and then a mutant will come along and unfix it again. But it'll go back and forth between being totally fixed and being a little bit unfixed. And so you can get at least a feel for the strength of mutation. And if you look at that, here's an important point. You're really comparing the mutation rate, whoops, is the mutation rate bigger than 1 over 4n? Okay, now I'm going to keep that up there because we're going to go on to natural selection, and we'll see there's a similar rule for natural selection. And you can get a feel for the balance of forces in the presence of genetic drift by comparing the very simple quantities like this. This calculation shows you the justification, but I'm going to go on to natural selection because it also leads us to a new technology that originated around 1930 in the work of Sewell Wright and a little earlier in one thing that R.I. Fisher did, but then gained a lot of, it was developed a lot in the 1950s and 60s, and that's what are called diffusion equations. And I'm not going to bog you down in diffusion equations. I have a fairly good explanation in Chapter 7. But what I'm going to do is, let's see, I'm going to take the projection off. Could you push that upper left button so that it turns off? Yes. And then do more on the board, but we'll come back and project one more thing. What I want to do is consider a population that's finite, in which a mutant is occurring. Here there are neutral mutations, but suppose we had a mutation that had a selective advantage. And we want to get some sort of feel for what its probability is of taking over the population. Now, in the deterministic theory, of course, any allele, no matter how rare, if it has a selective advantage, will ultimately increase in frequency in simple cases. But this is in a finite population. So there's a chance, due to genetic drift, that a favorable allele could be lost. And what we want to do is get a feel for that. There's a piece of work done in, I think it was 1927, by J.B.S. Haldane. And he made a nice simple approximation. They got a very useful result, which I'm going to whiz through how you get it, but it's described more in more detail in the book. The first thing he did is to say, suppose you have a big population. So it's not infinite, but it's big. And you have a single mutant. So let's imagine you had two N copies of the gene. And of these two N copies, one of them is a new mutant. And its fitness in heterozygote, that when it's rare, it's going to come up, it's going to be appearing essentially most of the time in heterozygotes. It will contribute copies to the gamete pool in a Wright-Fisher type model, but if its fitness is higher, it will contribute not the same number of copies of everybody else, but 1 plus s copies for every one that everybody else gives. So its frequency in the gamete pool is a bit higher. In fact, that's how you handle natural selection in Wright-Fisher models. You basically, you imagine a gamete pool, you basically make up newborns, an infinite number of newborns who are at Hardy-Weinberg frequencies for whatever was in the gamete pool. And then you let natural selection change the proportions of the newborns. And then we have sampling later on that allows only N of those to survive to adulthood. In each copy that you get in the next generation, when you come to sample it from the gamete pool here, the number of copies you'll get among the adults that you choose, let's say 2N copies. I'm burying a few details here, and if people see little inconsistencies, I'll have to explain them later after class. But if there are 2N copies that you're drawing from this gamete pool, the number that are big A, let's call all the other ones little a, will be 2n draws from a pool where the frequency of big A is 1 plus s over 2n. So the number of copies that you get will be a binomial distribution with this number of draws and this probability, not 1 over 2n, but 1 plus s over 2n. They're enriched a little bit by the natural selection. Now, I'm going to wave my hands in ways that can be, that are in the text, and say, well, if n is big but not infinite, then this approximately can be approximated by a Poisson distribution, which is the distribution you also use for counting bacterial plates on bacterial colonies on bacterial plates. It approximates a case where you have a lot of draws, each with a small probability. And so the number of copies of big A you get will be approximately Poisson distribution distributed with mean, with expectation, 1 plus s. Now, what Haldane did, and I'm going to have to whiz through what he actually did, but again, as I keep saying, and for the last part of the course, we're stuck, I've got to say it. What Haldane did was to say, well, let's ask about the probability of fixation of this new mutant, where there's no further mutation and no further anything except for the drift in the natural selection. And let's ask not about the probability of fixation, but about the probability of loss, which is just the opposite, just 1 minus the probability of fixation. If you can compute the one, you can compute the other. So if lambda is the probability of loss, then Haldane noted that if you go forward one generation, you start with one copy and you ask, what's the probability that it gets lost? Well, there is a possibility that there are no descendants of this in the next generation, in which case it gets lost, okay? That's being lost. You're there. And there's a possibility that the pen doesn't have enough ink. There's a possibility that this pen is also. There's a possibility that we're going to change color here. This is going to look embarrassing. Lambda P0. There's a probability that you get exactly one copy. If you get exactly one copy, the probability of getting lost is still the same as lambda. Or there's a probability of getting in the next generation two copies. The probability both of them get lost is lambda squared. Now, if you think about it, you'll see they aren't quite independent. Because in a finite population, if one dies, that sort of leaves more room for the other. But what he's going to do is approximate and say, well, while these genes are rare, which is when all this loss might occur, they approximately, the different copies don't know about each other. They're diluted so much in the population. Anyway, the result is he ends up with a big polynomial in terms of how many offspring you have. Hand wave, we can put in those terms, the probability of k offspring is where there's an average number of offspring of 1 plus s in a Poisson is e to the minus 1 plus s times 1 plus s to the k divided by k factorial. And I'm not going to go through the rest, but it is going through in the notes. If you plug that into here, you could collect things, and you end up with lambda equal e to the lambda, I got to get this right. Here we go. Yes. Lambda minus 1 times 1 plus s. And you look at that and say, well, okay, that's a formula. This is what he got in 1927. And you look at it and you say, well, okay, what's the solution of that? And the answer is there isn't any. There's no closed form formula for solving that. But you can do some good approximations. And you end up with, the answer is, approximately, but a pretty good approximation, lambda is equal to 1 minus 2s. So the probability of fixation, which is not loss but the opposite, is approximately twice the selection coefficient. And it turns out that's a darn good approximation. And I have some stuff in the notes about, well, a slightly better formula, you can modify a little. But this is good enough. It's good enough for our purposes. So that says if I have a favorable mutant in the population which has a selective advantage of 1%, what is the probability that it fixes? Well, if s equal 0.01, 2s, of course, is about twice that. So 2%. Now, that's an interesting figure, because what it says is 2% selective advantage, 2% probability of fixation, if you think about it, it's not very big. We have a population. Favorable mutants are coming along. Each time one comes along, it drifts down near, it's in a very tiny initial frequency, it's basically 1 over 2n, and it undergoes genetic drift, and there's a high chance that it gets lost. And of all the copies that occur, 98% of those favorable mutations are getting lost. And if you look at it, you'll say, that's ridiculously high. How can natural selection at all be effective if 98% of mutants that are favorable, in this case favorable in heterozygote, are destined to be lost and not get up to a high enough frequency to ever get fixed, to ever come anywhere near fixation? Well, for that, you want to compare this to the number that you would get if they were neutral. Now, in this approximation, if S is zero, the neutral case, then they must get lost. Well, that's not actually what happens. We just did this calculation with neutrality. And we know that for a neutral mutant that comes into the population, it's at frequency 1 over 2n initially. Okay. It's going to have some descendants. What is the chance that the descendants of that mutant will ultimately take over the population? They may not still be the same mutation, they might have subsequently mutated. But if everything were neutral, and the initial frequency is 1 over 2n, what's your probability that that copy takes over the population? I think you already know this.
1 over 2n?
It's 1 over 2n, because one of the initial copies is going to be randomly selected as the winner. And the chance that it'll be this one is 1 over 2n. So compare 2s for the selectively advantageous mutation to 1 over 2n. Okay. Now the question is, which is bigger? Okay. Well, 2s is 2s bigger than 1 over 2n? Well, that depends over, if you multiply through by 2n, whether 4ns is greater than 1. So we now see that, in fact, if 4 times n times the selection coefficient is bigger than 1, natural selection, even with a fixation probability that's as ridiculously low as 2s, is much more likely to get you fixed than this is. So, for example, if n is equal to 1,000,000 and S is equal to 0.01, then a neutral mutation will have a chance of fixation of 1 in 2,000,000, which is awfully small. A selected one, a chance of fixation of 2%. That's a heck of a lot bigger. Okay. How many times bigger is it? Well, it is 2s. Sorry, it is 2s over 1 over 2n, or 4ns times bigger than neutral, than a neutral. Or in this case, 4 million times 1/100, which is, if I'm correct, is 40,000. So in other words, a mutant that comes along that has a 1% selective advantage is 40,000 times more likely to fix than it would be if it is neutral. So that gives you a different perspective on this question of whether natural selection is effective. Yes, most favorable mutants get lost. That's the horrifying fact. On the other hand, an incredibly higher fraction of neutral mutants gets lost. And so natural selection is enriching the probability of fixation by a factor that's 4NS, which in this numerical example is a very large number. Yeah?
So you say 2N copies, but
yeah.
This isn't like a diploid system where like...
I'm thinking in terms of diploid here.
Okay, so...
You can do a similar thing for haploid.
So it's big A is 1 plus S squared?
No. Well, we haven't said. Well,
okay.
All we've said is whether in heterozygote,
okay,
its fitness is 1 plus S. Its
okay.
S fraction is bigger. We haven't actually said what's happening in homozygote. If the homozygote were lethal, the thing couldn't really fix. But we're talking about what happens down when it's so rare that basically you almost never see a homozygote. We're asking if it gets lost during that initial phase.
Okay.
Yeah. So I mean that's a very relevant, you know, thing to bring up so we can have a good intuition about this. Okay. Now where I'm going from here is to say, okay, can we get some better formulas? This approximation by Haldane sort of assumes the allele is always rare. You know, we're asking what happens when it's rare, which is exactly this point. Now, what about can we do something more sophisticated? And I'm just going to show you a computation that was done. Basically, the history is Haldane had this thing. In the late 1920s, Sewell Wright developed formulas for equilibrium distributions of gene frequencies where genetic drift versus various evolutionary forces genetic drifts was perturbing gene frequencies and evolutionary forces were moving them in the usual ways. The paper he published in 1931, where he published a gigantic paper showing many of these distributions, it's a real classic in evolutionary biology. It was a tremendous achievement. In addition to doing all the inbreeding coefficient stuff, inventing the concept, a few years later, he invented the concept of effective population size. He also happened to do this. And then later in the 1930s, it was pointed out to him that a Russian mathematician, a very famous one named Andrei Nikolaevich Kolmogorov, who was an interesting character, who was interested in genetics, but also interested in a lot of other processes. He did many, many things. He had a long, successful career in the scary politics of the Soviet Union. He always managed to bounce out on top no matter what happened. And ended up a very distinguished guy, invented the concept of algorithmic information theory, provided the first really good mathematical definition of probability, formalizing the definition of probability, but he also invented diffusion equations. And diffusion equations were a good way of describing processes like this. He did apply them a little bit to genetics, but then there was the repression of genetics in the Soviet Union under Stalin in the late 1930s, and Kolmogorov just switched his work away from genetics and managed to survive the experience. And Wright picked up Kolmogorov's formulas and started publishing papers using them. And then a little bit later in the 1950s, Moto Kimura, whose picture I showed you earlier, picked up on that and did more with it. And Kimura in 1962 came up with very nice fixation probability formula, which is what I want to get to in the next 20 minutes if I can talk fast enough. And basically what it does is approximate the changes of gene frequency, not by the exact right Fisher model, which this is sort of still using, but by jiggling of gene frequencies on a scale. And there are issues of scaling of the various forces and times that come up, and they're actually important, and I'm actually going to talk to you about the scaling stuff and then wave my hands and come up with equations. What we're going to do is say, let's imagine that the sill on the sill on this whiteboard is a gene frequency scale. You can't quite see the end, but there's that end which is zero and this end which is one. Now, in a Wright-Fisher model, you have a finite population size. Let's say it's 100. And then you have this gene frequency scale is discrete. There are a bunch of different possible gene frequencies ranging from 0 over 2n, 1 over 2n, 2 over 2n, all the way up to 2n over 2n, that's 1. So if there were n is 100, there are 200 different gene frequencies. Actually, there are 201 different gene frequencies, counting 0, counting 1. And any changes that you have in the Wright-Fisher model amount to jumps between gene frequencies, not necessarily adjacent ones. So the Wright-Fisher model has the gene frequency walking, doing a random walk back and forth under the influence of genetic drift and the deterministic evolutionary forces. And you're going forward in time in whole generations. Okay. So now what we want to do is consider instead a smooth scale of gene frequency where the gene frequency is undergoing a continuous time Brownian motion or something like a Brownian motion. It's a diffusion process a little bit different than a Brownian motion. And it's affected by selection, which tends on average to pull it more to the right, by maybe mutation coming in, if there are two alleles both ways, pushing mutation would be pushing you towards a mutational equilibrium point, selection would be pulling you on average to the right, and genetic drift is causing the thermal noise, it's causing the wiggling. And basically what diffusion equations do is to consider that process, which can be handled much more nicely mathematically, and approximate it to the Wright-Fisher models. And what we can do is consider some different Wright-Fisher models that look more and more like this. I'm going to erase all this stuff. And I'm going to say, suppose that we had, let's just consider selection and drift with no mutation. Suppose I had 100 individuals and I had a selection coefficient of, let me see if I get this right. Let's make it small, one part in let's say, 10,000. No, let's make it one part in 1,000. Okay. So we have small selection coefficient favoring the big A. And we look forward in time, one generation. We can approximately predict how much the selection will change the gene frequency. We have a rough idea of what genetic drift can do. Now suppose somebody comes along and says to you, and we can imagine thinking about what the ultimate fixation probability is if you start at some particular gene frequency, might be 1 over 2, and it might be something else, like 0.08. Okay. So we'll start with the gene frequency of 0.08. And we can think about that process. Now, if you simulate that process in the PopG program, the one that you just finished using, you can simulate it. You can look what happens in one generation or in larger numbers of generations. But you can also do a case with 1,000 individuals, and here's the catch, with a gene, I'm changing here. Let's make the selection coefficient 0.01. With a weaker selection, 0.001, and go forward, look forward in time 10 generations. Okay. Now, if you say, well, what's going to happen in those two cases? The first thing you might remember is that in genetic drift, if the population size is bigger, it takes correspondingly longer for genetic drift to work. And in fact, you'll get about the same amount of genetic drift in 10 generations with a population of size 1,000 as you get in one generation with a population size of 100. If you've got the selection coefficient also scaled, so it is 10 times weaker, you get about the same amount of selective change in that 10 generations. So we can at least wave our hands and say we think there's some reason for believing that selection will be doing about the same thing it would do in the first case, and so will drift, because we've got a bigger population size, but we got weaker selection, correspondingly weaker selection, and we're looking at a longer stretch of time that's just proportionately longer. And you can continue this process until you have very big population sizes, very small selection coefficients. In this case, it would be 10 to the minus 8. And you're looking forward now not 10 generations, but 1,000,000 generations. And what I can argue is that those cases are all going to have approximately the same outcome in terms of the fixation probability of big A, because they all have the same value of n times s, or let's make it 4ns. Here 4ns is 4, here 4ns is 4, and here 4ns is 4. So the magic quantity 4ns seems to be mostly controlling the fixation probability. Now, at this point, I have to, because we're, as usual, running out of time, I have to wave my hands a lot and say, if we develop equations for the change of gene frequencies in a case of where we're figuring out the fixation probability, and as usual, I'll say, you will find much more on this in the notes. You can end up with an equation for the fixation probability. And the fixation probability follows a differential equation in this case, I derive it in the notes, which says that if m of x is the mean gene frequency change, given that you're at gene frequency x, and v of x is the variance of that, of the gene frequency change, given that you're at x, it turns out that there is a diffusion equation, and this is the Kolmogorov forward equation, and if u of x is the fixation probability if you start at x, then you get 0 equals, let's see, boom. I had it right down here a second ago. Yeah, there it is. M of, let's call it x, but in the notes it's p, times the first derivative, that's the prime, it's not the value in the next generation, but it's first derivative, plus v of x over 2 times the second derivative of u. And you look at that and you say, well, if you're like me, you panic at the sight of a differential equation. I'm not very comfortable with differential equations. But if you, and then we'll say, what is m of x? In the case we're talking about, it's approximately s times x times 1 minus x, which is the numerator of the selection equation. The v of x variance is x times 1 minus x over 2n. It's the binomial variance. When you plug those in, you can solve this equation. When you solve this equation, Kimura gives a formula for the solution that is in terms of general functions m of x and v of x, that's in the notes. But the solution comes out to be, we open the envelope and see what the answer is, but in recent days, that's not a good analogy. The fixation probability starting at a gene frequency p for the simple form of selection, this is for multiplicative selection. So fitnesses are 1 plus s squared to 1 plus s to 1. Simple form of selection. It's 1 minus e to the minus 4nsp. There's that magic quantity 4ns over 1 minus e to the minus 4ns. And that was derived by Moto Kimura in 1962, published in Genetics in 1962. And it's a wonderful formula because it really shows you exactly how much effect selection has. And one thing it shows is if p is 1 over 2n, if you start out with a single copy, then this comes out to be 1 minus e to the minus 2s over 1 minus e to the minus 4ns, which is very, very close to Haldane's value of 2s. It'll come out for reasonable size populations. It fits Haldane's result very nicely. When there's no selection, it becomes 0 over 0, but you may know that for cases like that, we have L'Hopital's theorem, and you can go to limits, and what do you get out? If S equals 0, you get out the gene frequency. And what is that? That's the neutral result. Okay, that's the result we know and love. So let me now show you a picture of what this function looks like. It's in the notes. Could you push that? Yeah. And once the projector wakes up. Yeah, this is a wonderful time. You'll have to shout because of the noise up
here.
Yeah,
no worries. In the previous time, when we assumed the allele rare was rare, if you had one copy, it was 1 plus s over 2n. In this case,
well, the fraction of the gamete pool would be 1 plus s over 2n. So then when you're making draws out of the gamete pool, that's the chance that you pick it each time.
And so that's not the initial gene frequency. The initial gene frequency.
Well, it's in that generation, the effect of selection is as if it boosted its initial gene frequency from 1 over 2n up to 1 plus s over 2n. It multiplied it by 1 plus s. Now, let me just show you this graph of Kimura's formula with a little bit of luck. Oh, I'm supposed to. There we go. There it is. Now, this is that formula for different values of 4ns. With different initial gene frequencies. So let's first of all consider the fact of no selection. S equals 0. Where is that? Well, that one, here's the curve for plus 4ns plus 0.1, and here's the curve for minus 0.1. It's between them. And what is that? It's just a 45-degree line. The initial frequency equals the fixation probability. Comes out beautifully in. Now you put in a little bit of positive selection. 4ns is 0.1. It barely moves that curve. It moves it up a little. It bends it slightly upwards, but you can hardly see it. When 4ns gets up to 1, then it bends the thing noticeably. If you start with a gene frequency of, say, 30%, its probability of fixation here is 30%, but here the probability of fixation is around somewhere in the low 40s. So it's starting to move the fixation probability up. Remember, when I say starting to, I'm not talking about going in time. Each one of these numbers is an outcome of running the whole process and waiting to see what happens at the end. But I mean, if considering one case after another, as we get to the case of 4NS equal 1, now we're in a case where the fixation probability is sort of noticeably above 30%. Get up to 4NS equal 10, look at this, okay? It's having a strong effect. Get up to 4NS of 100, and there it goes rocketing up, and then gets to almost to 100%, way down. If you had more than 10% of these in the population, you're just about guaranteed that they'll fix. Although, remember, most favorable mutants get lost. If you start out with a gene frequency of 10%, you have quite a few copies of them. Many of those will get lost, but at least one of them is going to win most of the time in this. So there you see the effect of natural selection favoring big A. But now look down here. Now, in Haldane's result, if there were a negative selection coefficient, it gives you a negative number, which doesn't make any sense. In Haldane's result, the fixation probability of anything that's selected against is basically zero. Kimura's gives you a more nuanced view. With weak negative selection for an S of minus 0.1, there's a small effect depressing you below neutrality. With minus 1, it's more substantial. With minus 10, you're starting to depress the probability of fixation a lot. So, for example, starting out with half the population consisting of this deleterious allele, it still gets lost. Whereas if it were neutral, it would have a 50% chance of fixing. With 4NS of minus 100, well, forget it. The probability of fixation is going to be tiny unless you start out with a very large number of copies. So you get a feeling for how effective positive selection is and how effective negative selection is. And it validates the simple calculation that I made with Haldane's result, which is that seeing whether 4NS is greater than 1, which is comparing 1 over 4N to S, okay, it tells you when selection really starts to have a noticeable effect. It's this bent curve up or the corresponding bent curve down. In case you wonder, of course, this diagram flips around the 45-degree line. These are symmetrical. But the other thing it tells you, and I'll end on this, is what range of selection coefficients is so small that they don't have any effect? In the deterministic theory, well, it doesn't matter how small they are, sooner or later they have an effect. But once there's genetic drift around, if 4NS is much less than 1, say it's below 0.1, that mutant, basically what happens is genetic drift runs its course before selection can move the gene frequency very much. And the result is it'll have a fixation probability that's just about the same as a neutral mutant. So the range of neutral mutations, nobody has a selection coefficient of exactly zero. But if you're within a range of plus or minus 0.1 in this 4NS value, then you'll act as if you're neutral. And that runs counter to the intuition of a lot of people. We have a lot of people working in this department. There are a number of very active groups working on experimental evolution, and they like to set up cultures of yeast where things compete against each other, little population cages, little chemostats, where yeast compete against each other. And then they try to detect selection. And I've heard a lot of people give talks and say, well, we can detect selection of 0.1, you know, S equal 0.1, and that's okay, that's selection. But then they'll say, sometimes we measure a selection coefficient of only 0.01. Oh, that's weak selection. And what I have to say is, no, it isn't. 0.01 is not weak selection. Do this calculation. Imagine a population size of, you know, like n equal 10 to the fifth. S equal 0.01 means ns is equal to 1,000. And 4ns, if you're diploid, 4,000. And where is that on this diagram? Where is the curve for 4,000? It goes rocketing up here. And, you know, it's not plotted, but it would be scarcely distinguishable from the axes. That amount of selection in a population of size 100,000 is fantastically strong. So there's a disconnect between people working on experimental evolution who tend to say, if I can't detect it easily, then it's not there. And people working in population genetics who tend to say, selection coefficients have got to be down near the reciprocal of the population size to have to be weak enough to qualify as neutral. So I've, as usual, kept you over. And as usual, the howling mob is outside trying to get in. We're going to continue on next time. And that's when we'll start talking about the coalescent, which is a very important topic. If you don't come next time, listen to the audio.